From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week saw the first sprinkling of what is likely to be a deluge of campaign advertising from a gathering storm of cumulonimbus known as super PACs. There's a pro-Obama super PAC called Priorities USA, a pro-Romney super PAC called Restore Our Future, and a pro-Perry super PAC called Make Us Great Again. Be afraid. Very.
Since the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United case last year, certain political action committees may now collect unlimited contributions without disclosing
the
people.
It's incomprehensible how much more screwed up it is now than it was before Citizens United.
It is inarguable that these organizations exist for no other purpose but to elect the candidates that they are associated with.
Super PACs were the direct result of the Citizens United decision, in which the Supreme Court held that the government can't stop corporations or unions from spending money to persuade voters. Super PACs may spend unlimited amounts of money so long as they don't directly coordinate with a candidate's campaign. The Karl Rove-linked super PAC American Crossroads and its nonprofit partner Crossroads GPS have announced they plan to spend $240 million in 2012, double what they'd first projected. This week, in what's seen as the start of the super PAC TV ad downpour, Make Us Great Again began running pro-Perry TV ads in two key primary states, South Carolina and Iowa. And the pro-Obama super PAC released some anti-Romney web ads. Peter H. Stone of the Center for Public Integrity says he expected the super PAC ads would be especially negative, but the Perry ads are downright sunny so far.
One thing that struck people about the first ads was that they were softer and a little bit friendlier than people expected.
His dad was a tenant farmer, his wife a nurse.
Rick Perry. These were ads that basically tried to boost Perry's image by talking about his accomplishments in Texas.
Manufacturing exports, past major lawsuit.
Many of the super PACs are seen as having the ability to do more negative ads because they're not formally connected.
Make Us Great Again is responsible for the content of this ad.
In fact, they're not legally allowed to be connected to the campaigns or the candidates in any way.
Okay, but most of us who have been following this have the sense that there is barely an angstrom of space between these super PACs and the campaigns. However, technically, they may be fulfilling the letter of the law.
Many of these super PACs have been set up by former close associates of the candidates. In the case of Perry, it was his former chief of staff and a longtime donor in Texas. The Romney super PAC was started by three people who were connected to his last presidential bid. And in the case of Obama, we have his former deputy White House spokesman, Bill Burton, and a top White House aide, Sean Sweeney, who started that one. So there's that level of ties. There are also other ties. You have candidates who are allowed to go to fundraisers for
super PACs that have no ties to their campaign.
Exactly. The rule that the Federal Election Commission has written is, yes, you can go to the super PAC events, you can thank people for coming, you can ask them for limited contributions.
Yeah, you can ask them for up to $5,000, but they can give as much as
Correct.
They want.
Correct. They can give $500,000 or a million, and many of these super PACs are being fueled by donations on that order. But the candidate themselves is not allowed to ask for the unlimited amount of money.
Why is it that the Republicans are so far out in front of the Democrats in super PAC fundraising?
There are a couple of big reasons for that. One is that the Republican National Committee, which has long been a chief fundraising vehicle for Republicans, was in turmoil because its chairman, Michael Steele, alienated a lot of the big donors. And strategists like Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie realized they needed something else to help Republican candidates in 2010. That was even before the Supreme Court ruled on Citizens United. And together, these two factors really helped get the Republican groups off the ground in a big way.
But what about President Obama's criticism of the Citizens United decision? Do you think that set the Democrats back in super PAC funding? Were they afraid that they would look hypocritical?
They were concerned about the hypocrisy factor. And the White House had even quietly urged them not to start too many of these groups. They didn't have the kind of organizational problems that Republicans had. And they had unions, too, who were always powerful allies and were powerful allies again last year.
But now the Democrats do have super PACs up and running, including Obama. Does this mean that the party has abandoned its principles or that the president has?
It does open him up to hypocrisy charges. But they also say, look, the Republicans have done this. They won the last election in part because of their outside groups. And they justify it as they're not going to go into a major election year with one hand tied behind their backs.
Peter, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Peter Stone is group leader for Money and Politics at iWatch News, which is part of the Center for Public Integrity. The path of campaign finance regulation has been long and twisted, leading all the way back to Watergate. Picture this. The year, 1971. The place, the White House. The industry using illegal campaign money to grease the wheels, Big Milk. Here's NPR's Peter Overby.
If you go to the Watergate tapes, you can hear Nixon meeting with the milk producers in the cabinet room, joshing with them. And then later that same day, there's a tape of an Oval Office meeting with Nixon and his advisors. They all agree that the milk subsidy isn't going to be cut. It's going to be raised. At the end of the tape, John Ehrlichman, the domestic advisor, makes a joke about, let's all go get a glass of milk while it's still cheap. And everybody laughs.
Very funny. But that encounter with Big Milk was a big scandal at the time, right?
The milk producers wanted to give $2 million to help Nixon get reelected. That was a scandal. Then, as now, direct contributions from corporations to political campaigns was illegal.
And that led to the creation of the Federal Election Commission?
Right. You had several laws coming through Congress as the Watergate scandal evolved. First was disclosure by the candidate committees and the party committees. Then laws that encouraged the rise of political action committees. Things stayed on an even keel for a few election cycles. And then in the late 80s, you had the rise of soft money, corporate money and union money and money from rich individuals going to the party committees.
In reaction to that, there was the great bipartisan effort known as McCain-Feingold.
The way to look at it is the Watergate era laws set limits on the amount of money and the kind of money that could come into federal election campaigns. Soft money was a way around that. McCain-Feingold cut off the flow of soft money. As soon as McCain-Feingold became law, there were efforts to poke holes in it, and it's been gradually perforated.
Okay, so one of the ways it was weakened, I believe, was the rise of, and I wish these things didn't all have numbers attached to them, groups called 527s. One of them famously gave rise to the term swift voting. How did they work around McCain-Feingold, and do they still matter?
The appealing thing about them was that they had no contribution limits. They could spend as much as they wanted from any source they wanted on mostly attack ads. And in the early days, there was no disclosure. Politicians on both sides were targeted. They didn't like it. Congress passed a law forcing disclosure. After that, a lot of the outside money shifted to another type of group, the 501c4 issue advocacy groups.
Wait a minute. I think I know those. Those are those tax-exempt groups that are not supposed to devote the majority of their money to political ads, right?
To political spending, yeah. The way 501c4s are working nowadays, a lot of them, they are running attack ads during campaign season. And during the off season, they're running ads on legislation in Congress, tying it to certain incumbents or certain parties. So the message is a partisan slash ideological message. But it's not crossing over the line what would be considered campaign express advocacy messaging.
What I learned essentially from Stephen Colbert is that if you create one of these entities, you can funnel that non-disclosed money into the super PAC, and all anybody needs to know is that it came from that 501c4.
Right. There are several super PACs that have 501c4s running alongside them. American Crossroads is one. Crossroads GPS is the C4 sidekick. There's a Rick Perry super PAC that has a 501c4 connected to it. And the super PAC that's supporting President Obama also has a C4 connected to it.
So again, just as the description of what constitutes campaign ads is pretty much meaningless, so it seems is this disclosure requirement. What with the creation of these non-disclosing sidekick organizations that can funnel money. So every restriction is basically zeroed out by a loophole practically from the outset.
And in fact, the coming battle over political money is whether there should be as much disclosure as there has been. There's a big push on the conservative side to limit disclosure, saying that the message is the important thing and the electorate doesn't gain anything really by knowing who's behind the message.
Do you think when we look back, the election of 2012 will seem like the Wild West?
It seems that way now. I'm not sure that by the time we get to 2016 or 2020, it's still going to look that way. There's a steady evolution in the judicial thinking away from anti-corruption rationale that was prevalent in the 70s and toward the ascendancy of First Amendment free speech rights. With the justices that are on the Supreme Court, it seems like the die is cast for things to continue that way for quite a while.
So you're talking about potentially going from the wild, wild west to Mad Max.
No comment.
Okay, Peter, thank you very much.
Sure. Glad to do it.
Peter Overby is the greatest title in NPR history, NPR's power, money, and influence correspondent.
Coming up, a law that was designed to protect children is being broken by parents.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If you've ever read the terms of service for sites like Gmail or Facebook, you may have noticed that in order to sign up for the sites, users have to be at least 13 years old. This age cutoff for restricting users is one way that companies have responded to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, which regulates how companies can collect and use information about children under 13. As the name suggests, the act is meant to protect children's privacy. But a study released this week suggests that the opposite may be happening. Parents are helping their kids lie to get onto Facebook, which then tracks them as if they were old enough to be tracked. Dana Boyd is a media researcher and one of the authors of the study. Dana, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me the origins of COPPA.
The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act was created in 1998 to protect young people's privacy, both with targeted marketing and also with physical safety. Now, 1998 was a long time ago, and in many ways at that time, the kinds of sites that were, you know, collecting data about children were often doing it for targeted marketing. And they decided that children under the age of 13 would be more vulnerable to manipulation online. So the law was extremely well-intended. But a decade later, things have changed radically. And the social media sites that we see and the communication platforms, you know, the Gmails and Skypes, as well as the Facebooks and Twitters, part of participation involves sharing content.
Now, the authors of the legislation imagined that this under 13 cutoff would oblige the Facebooks of the world to get affirmative parental consent for anyone 12 or younger to use these sites. But instead, something very different took place.
Correct. there are sites that directly target children who are under the age of 13. And those sites actually go through a whole set of procedures based on the requirements of COPPA to comply. And those sites actually collect credit card information or require a lot more information to be shared by parents for participation. The communication services that we all know and love and the social network sites, they find that complying is actually too complex for them. So what happens with parents who don't have a credit card, parents who don't want to give more data about their children for them to participate, parents who are for various reasons uninvolved with their kids' lives, all of this sort of makes the whole space a real mess. So by and large, the companies who are dealing with general purpose sites just decided, you know what, we'll just focus on 13 plus.
Okay, so the terms of service for Facebook, for example, or Gmail say you have to be 13 because they don't want to be involved in the morass of qualifying underage users. And that's where it ends, right? Parents say, oops, sorry. No, you're too young. You can't be on Facebook.
No, unfortunately, one of the things that we learned in this study was that parents, not only do they know that their under 13 children are on these sites, but they're also helping them create their accounts. And they're doing so en masse. What was most surprising to me was the fact that almost 3/4 of parents, regardless of whether their kid was on Facebook or not, thought that it was perfectly acceptable for their child to violate minimum age restrictions. I was also completely surprised at how many parents thought that the age restrictions were a recommendation and not a requirement.
You mean like a PG movie recommendation as opposed to the law of the land?
A lot of parents are really used to MPAA ratings, and they make a decision as a parent whether or not to allow their tween to get access to that PG-13 movie. Likewise, I think that one of the things that we're seeing from this data is that parents are interpreting these age restrictions as a general recommendation. They're saying, hey, okay, this is probably only appropriate for kids 13 or above, but my child, you know, is perfectly mature, or my child is in an environment where I can support him or her and make certain she understands, you know, how to interact in these spaces. And so they're using this and saying, this is a general guideline, and they don't want restrictions, and they don't want the government, they don't want companies to step in and tell them how to be a parent. In fact, one of the things that was very clear in our data, 93% of parents said that they should have the final say about what happens with their kids online.
But I'll bet you if you said to the parents who had lied to get their kids online, how would you feel if the website were tracking your child's traffic all across the internet? They would say, oh, it would be horrible. No, no, don't let them do that.
Not only did we ask them if they're concerned about targeted marketing, we asked them how frequently if they thought their kids were on the receiving end of targeted marketing. And while parents were actually quite concerned, a huge number of them reported that their kids were not being exposed to targeted marketing, which is most likely to be completely inaccurate. By and large, participation in online environments means that you are actually on the receiving end of targeted marketing.
So let's say my 10-year-old says to me, Daddy, I want to be on Facebook. And I, for whatever reason, say, sure. And she says, well, you know, it says you have to be 13. And I say, oh, we'll fix that. How do I fix that? What do I have to do to violate these terms of service?
To get past Facebook's process, you actually have to make her birth date so that she is now currently over the age of 13. And you may have to actually erase the cache, open it up in a new browser, because Facebook does try to make it difficult for you to just keep changing your age in order to get access. Over half of parents of 12-year-olds report that their kid has a Facebook account. This is by no means something that just a few people are doing. And, you know, not only that, 76% of those actually assisted in creating those accounts.
So in addition to whatever my child may be exposed to in terms of data tracking or content, we are also having this nice parent-child exercise in learning how to, lie.
One of the things about these violations is that they've completely normalized lying. Lying has become status quo. For young people, when you've normalized the idea that lying will keep you safe, that lying is the way to get access, we have to raise serious questions as a culture to say, well, what are the implications that this has? It's not just happening in the home. I was, you know, aghast to watch how often law enforcement comes in during assemblies and tells kids that in order to be safe online, they should actually lie about their location. So kids are hearing messages all around them that lying is both the way to get access and the way to be safe online. One of the funny things you will find on these sites is that a huge number of kids actually say that they're from Afghanistan or Zimbabwe, which are the countries alphabetically at the top and the bottom of the possible countries you could be from. So based on the stats of Facebook and MySpace, there are more people online in Afghanistan and Zimbabwe than there are living there.
Dana, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dana Boyd is a media researcher and co-author of the study, Why Parents Help Their Children Lie to Facebook About Age, Unintended Consequences of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Backpage.com, which is owned by Village Voice Media, is a classified ad site, not unlike Craigslist. You can look for a job there, sell a car, find a vintage Quick Draw McGraw lunchbox, almost anything, including flesh, escorts, body rubs, fetish services, the whole panoply of offerings under the heading of adult. But what about when the adults aren't? Episodes of Backpage.com ads involving minors have put the owners in a harsh spotlight. The Reverend Catherine Rhodes Henderson is the president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City and part of Groundswell, a group of interdenominational clergy who took out an ad in the New York Times last week asking Village Voice Media to shut down the adult section of Backpage.com. Reverend Henderson says that just this week, a pair of sex traffickers in Memphis were indicted on charges that they sold underage girls for sex.
We're talking about girls, teenage girls, ages 15 and 16, and they thought they were going to a water park and instead were lured into a sex trafficking ring. This took place in Memphis. They were trafficked all the way to Houston, and they were sold through ads on Village Voice Media's Backpage.com adult section. This is a tragic situation that's replicated many times over, and it's devastating to the lives of these girls.
Now, there have been rather frightening statistics bandied about concerning child prostitution in the United States, but they have been shown to be wildly exaggerated. Nonetheless, I gather that there isn't any threshold that you're comfortable with, like, oh, only 1,000 teen hookers, you know, that's manageable.
Our position is that one child sold for sex on a classified ad site is too many. To have 51 states' attorneys generals join together and be unified around this concern suggests that this is a serious problem and something that we all need to be concerned about.
Village Voice Media has invested what it says is millions of dollars in an attempt to detect child exploitation and to refuse to accommodate suspicious would-be advertisers. Now, Backpage.com is in your sights because it benefited from Craigslist shutting down its adults-only ad section under pressure. If Backpage.com were to close, then those ads would go somewhere else, you know, possibly someplace that makes no multi-million dollar effort at due diligence. In the New York Times this week, David Carr called that a whack-a-mole. You know, you pound the mole, it's just going to pop up somewhere else.
When Craigslist shut down its adult services section, it actually had a significant impact in decreasing the amount of child sex trafficking. And yes, Backpage benefited greatly from Craigslist being shut down, making Backpage now the leading online site for adult service ads. But we believe that if we can get Village Voice Media's Backpage.com to shut this section down, that it will wipe out the majority of online sex trafficking of minors. And we feel that we have to try that. We have to push this point.
But what happens when you succeed and the ads turn up somewhere else that is less scrupulous about who the advertisers are?
We are hoping really to create a cultural change where Americans are going to become aware of this as an issue right in their backyards, so that should there be a site that arises in the future, that public outcry would be sufficient to shut it down.
Okay, so I want you to humor me for a moment. I want you to stipulate for me that the possibility is that I'm right, that when you close Backpage.com down, it will just move elsewhere. In the meantime, you will have done serious damage to a very fine news organization that depends on this ad category for like 30 to 35% of its revenues. Now, I'm not equating a newspaper business with human life, but if you've gained nothing and kill the Village Voice in the process.
There are lives at stake here, and profit doesn't have a place when you're talking about the lives of children.
Now, Michael Lacey, who is the CEO of Village Voice Media, has framed this as a freedom of speech issue, as a matter of principle on his side. Is it that? Is it a question of the freedom of all advertisers to sell their wares?
I am not an attorney, but I know that the First Amendment doesn't extend to illegal sex trafficking. And Village Voice Media is providing a platform for the criminal activity of others. I think that's beyond free speech. But we're here to address this as a moral issue. We believe that we have to protect the children in our midst and that they should not be subjected to sex trafficking, which is a devastating, traumatic experience from which often there's no return.
Catherine, thank you very much.
Bob, thank you for having me. Thanks for the opportunity.
The Reverend Catherine Rhodes Henderson is president of Auburn Theological Seminary. We tried unsuccessfully to reach Village Voice Media executives Jim Larkin and Mike Lacey to get their side. A rep for Village Voice Media said they had no comment. New York Times media and culture writer David Carr wrote in his column this week that, quote, a free press is not free, referencing the fact that the Village Voice needs revenue from Backpage.com in order to keep its publications afloat. Carr says that just because Village Voice Media is taking a stand that happens to align with its business interests doesn't mean that the stand isn't valid.
In editorial matters and advertising matters, they're pretty much libertarian. It's an anything-goes approach, and the assumption over and over is that it's adults marketing to adults. Village Voice Media says we do thousands and thousands and thousands of ads. And every once in a while, maybe something sneaks through, but we've spent a lot on computer and human interdiction of that kind of material and have forwarded on to the Center for Missing Children and law enforcement authorities. And you'd rather have us keeping watch than some skeevy internet site you've never heard of.
Understood. And David, I'm not asking you to defend the position of Village Voice Media, but they did speak to you and they wouldn't speak to us. The critics say, yeah, but one life at risk is too many. And if they were out of this business, at least they wouldn't be putting that life at risk. How do they deal with the kind of moral argument that, why are you even in this game?
Well, I think there's significant moral hazard in all aspects of the advertising business. If you market cigarettes, if you market alcohol, both of those things. Anytime that you advocate for a free and truly open press, it's going to have costs, and perhaps one of the costs is every once in a while inappropriate advertising is going to sneak through. And part of what they probably think about is, you know, they have 13 weeklies that are doing great work in their respective communities. It's an important part of their funding base. They run the site responsibly. They do their best to make sure that no minors are being bought and sold on what they do. I'm pretty sure both Mr. Lacey and Mr. Larkin sleep pretty good at night.
All right. Now, David, I'm speaking to you not only because you wrote about this in your New York Times column, but because you actually had a real role in the debate back when you were in the alt-weekly game yourself.
I was the editor of a weekly in Minneapolis called the Twin Cities Reader, and we made a decision that we weren't going to take ads which we felt objectified women. So that was stripper ads, escort ads, veiled prostitution ads, massage ads. And you know what? We probably lost 15 to 20% of our revenue base, which went on to our competitors and other people. And when Village Voice came to town to buy a paper, they bought the other paper, closed the one I worked at down. So yes, we were right, but I don't know how victorious we would be. the paper ended up out of business.
Can you foresee a situation where, assuming they can somehow get Backpage.com shut down, that the cure becomes worse than the disease?
Well, if the second oldest profession is prostitution, the third oldest is trying to stamp it out. That hasn't gone very well. And once you put it on the web, I think it allows people to operate in unseen ways. And, you know, if you look at like the Communications Decency Act, hosts have not been held liable for the content that's on their site. And, you know, you could argue about the appropriateness of it, but that is the law of the land. If people use the U.S. mail to ship inappropriate information, including, let's say, pornography that uses minors, you don't go and shut down the post office. And I think they're trying to make that analogy.
Yeah, it sounds fetching for about a moment, but the post office doesn't know what's in the packages, does it?
Well, Village Voice would argue they don't know what's in the packages either.
Yeah, they claim not to know what's in it. But I don't know if those escort services have ever escorted anyone to the opera.
Well, if that was part of someone's kink, they probably would be more than happy to do it.
David, thank you as always.
A pleasure to speak with you, Bob.
David Carr writes a column about media and culture for The New York Times.
Coming up, the latest public radio firing and whether the age-old rule that bans activism is ripe for revision.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, supporting Small Business Saturday, and committed to supporting small businesses every day. ConstantContact.com/Saturday. The Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, NPR's interim CEO Joyce Slocum joined us to discuss NPR's decision to end distribution of the show World of Opera because host Lisa Simeone was engaged in political advocacy. As our show was being put to bed, unbeknownst to us, a similar drama was unfolding at our parent station, WNYC. The station ended its relationship with Caitlin Curran, a freelance web producer for The Takeaway, produced by WNYC and PRI, because she had participated in an Occupy Wall Street protest. It was Curran herself who informed management when she proposed a story about how a photo of her brandishing a sign at the rally went viral. The sign, by the way, bore the uncontroversial message that it is wrong to sell worthless mortgage-backed securities. Curran's dismissal for violating the station's policy on advocacy was described by her boss as a teaching moment. The question is, what did it teach? Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me what you were doing at Occupy Wall Street that day.
Well, I went down there because I just felt like it was a big, major thing that's happening in our time and trying to observe a major news story that's going on.
I understand the impulse. I once went to the Million Man March under approximately the same circumstances, but I didn't prepare a sign beforehand.
You know, my boyfriend was holding the sign. He was tired and he wanted to take some photos. And so I held the sign for literally just a few moments and somebody took a photo of me. Later that day, the photographer posted the picture on Twitter. The next day, Boing Boing posted it as their Occupy Wall Street photo of the day, and it kind of blew up from there.
Now, I just want to clarify a couple of things. Your boyfriend didn't take you there at gunpoint. You know, you worked
right
together on the sign.
Sure.
You were a participant in this rally, and clearly in the ethics policy for WNYC, journalists are forbidden from publicly taking up political advocacy.
You know, I think I thought of it in the moment when I was holding up the sign as the sign was something that wasn't political. I didn't consider the Occupy movement to be a political thing since it's not been affiliated with a particular party.
Nonpartisan maybe, but not non-ideological. Occupy Wall Street is almost entirely the province of the political left, is it not?
I think at this point it's still developing, and there's so many different people involved in the movement all over the world with different intentions for it. I mean, and that's what's gotten it some criticism, is that it's not specific enough. So, I mean, I think it's too early to say whether it's on the left or right.
Okay, I don't buy that answer, but I'm going to end the prosecution there because I don't want to litigate your case. What I do want to ask you about is whether the ethics policy that you were held to makes sense in the world we are now living in. There has been a lot of debate over the subject of whether it's fundamentally dishonest to pretend that journalists, A, don't have political opinions of their own, and B, can't be professional in their jobs while simultaneously having a point of view. Mm-hmm. How much have you thought about that issue over the last few days?
I thought about it a lot. I do think that journalists can publicly support something and they can still be trusted to report on things in a fair way. I think I've always exercised fair and balanced decision-making in my role as a web producer at The Takeaway and in past jobs that I've had as well. In this age of Twitter and Facebook, journalists are just out there in public all the time. I think it's impossible to not express your opinions at some point.
All right, now let's talk about reality for a moment.
Sure.
A substantial number of Americans, and a lot of them in Congress, believe that public radio is a sump of leftist propaganda. Likewise, a certain number of Americans, many of whom you were probably rubbing shoulders with the other day at Occupy Wall Street, believe that public radio will toady up to our corporate masters at any moment. The reasons for the ethics policies, it seems to me, is to give people on both sides of that argument no reason to say, aha, you became a smoking gun by virtue of just being where you were that day. Does that not harm the cause of all public broadcast journalists?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I'm definitely not advocating for Congress to defund a very important institution in our country. And I think that they do exercise a lot of balanced reporting in terms of reporting from the right and left. But, you know, I think that the same standards aren't applied to all employees. And that's part of the problem, I guess.
What is the solution?
This is something that happened in my personal time, and I think that news organizations can allow its journalists to have opinions about things but still present fair and balanced reporting.
Caitlin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Caitlin Curran was, until recently, a part-time web producer for The Takeaway, produced by PRI and WNYC, our producing station. WNYC declined our request for an interview, but a statement released by the station says, quote, The Takeaway has covered the Occupy Wall Street story since its beginning through active reporting on the protests and the positive and negative responses to those events. When Ms. Curran made the decision to participate in the protest and make herself part of the story, she violated our editorial standard.
Wake up, public media people, wrote New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen in his Press Think blog. You don't get to decide whether you have political enemies or not, but you can decide how to respond to them. The default setting is a series of political defeats. Rosen's been frustrated with public radio's recent spate of firings, including the punting of former NPR president Vivian Schiller after a doctored sting tape was released, produced by conservative activist James O'Keefe, also by WNYC's dismissal of Caitlin Curran, and also by NPR's decision to drop distribution of World of Opera because its host Lisa Simeone had engaged very publicly in political advocacy. But not all pink slips are created equal. So I asked him, if World of Opera is still being distributed, which it is, and Simeone still hosts, which she does, was there really any damage done?
I think the only damage in that case has really been to NPR, which has shown that it will back down from public controversy and will even, as in the earlier case, which I've also written about, fire its CEO over these kinds of things.
I think the big problem is our tendency to conflate all these firings. The Vivian Schiller firing, the former NPR president, was a kind of bizarre reflex. But Caitlin Curran worked for an organization that had rules common throughout traditional media institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Excessively broad or not, they nevertheless exist.
Right. That's true. But I don't think these rules are helping public radio gain trust. They certainly haven't dimmed the culture war atmosphere surrounding NPR and its funding at all. It would be wiser for public radio to start transitioning to a system in which it acknowledges that its people have political lives and they ought to be transparent about it. That certainly happened when Bob Garfield started his Comcast Must Die campaign. He was acknowledging that he has political convictions sometimes and decides sometimes to act on them, and WNYC was perfectly fine with that.
The fact is, Bob's thought experiment caused a lot of consternation, and I interviewed him on this program about the potential appearance of conflict of interest. He thought recusing himself from discussions of Comcast was sufficient. I disagreed.
I'm actually on Bob's side. I think if his convictions are displayed publicly, if they're explained on the air, and he is transparent about what he's doing, that ultimately is going to lead to more trust in the long run, fewer controversies, and fewer CEOs fired as a result of culture war tricksters like James O'Keefe.
What do you think of the argument that if you don't go about publicly proclaiming feelings and beliefs, you may be less impelled to defend them and freer to change your mind?
Oh, I think there's something to that, definitely. I think there's a risk in taking a stand or declaring yourself in any way. But I think you should measure that against the risk of false balance.
False balance meaning giving two unequal sides equal weight in order to duck the accusation of bias, even if that misrepresents a story. Fairness bias.
Fairness bias is a huge problem in public radio, in my opinion, as is political timidity. I think there are risks to complete nonpartisanship at all time, and the risk is that any slight deviation from an image of perfection becomes a huge deal. And when you aren't making this claim that your people have no starting point, they aren't coming from anywhere, they don't have any convictions, they don't have any politics, you actually have less trouble.
Do you think Caitlin Curran should have been fired?
No. First of all, it might be a good rule for WNYC to not try and control the lives of people that you don't give health insurance to. The fact that she's not an employee, I think, is relevant because WNYC is not investing in her career as much as it could. I would say there are limits to how much control we should have over freelancers, and I would say that we have to have different ways of getting at a complex event like a demonstration. People who have declared no interest, no stake, and don't participate are able to tell the story of Occupy Wall Street, and people who do participate are able to tell the story of Occupy Wall Street. And it seems to me that public radio has grown up enough and mature enough to handle both.
What's wrong with different kinds of institutions deciding on different kinds of reporting? You have right-wing news organizations, left-wing ones, and ones in the center. And maybe the ones in the center, like public radio, may occasionally commit fairness bias. But they are also capable of doing a kind of reporting that those more inflected organizations just can't.
No, I wouldn't disagree with any of that. But I would also say that what really matters in generating trust is that your stuff holds up under scrutiny. That is, it's true and accurate based on fact, and you're transparent in where you're coming from. And if you combine those two things, you're good.
Jay, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Jay Rosen teaches journalism at NYU and blogs at pressthink.org. Laura Amico runs Homicide Watch DC, a crime website she launched a year ago. The goal of the site is to provide a narrative from start to finish of every homicide in the DC area. Like most crime reporters, she spends much of her time interviewing the police and community activists and watching criminal trials. But for the last few months, she's found a new way to identify homicide victims before the police release the names. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
So first of all, why is it so important to release the names before the police do?
People are talking about crimes that they're seeing, and they want there to be a place to find information and connect right away. They want to leave memorial messages for the victim. They want to talk about the suspect. It's about providing crime coverage that is complete and honors the experiences that people have in their lives, in their experiences with violent crime.
So how do you get the jump on the cops?
By watching Twitter and Facebook and my web search analytics.
Okay.
Basically, what happens is that someone goes to a search engine, Google or Bing or something like that, and types in what they want information about, right?
Mm-hmm.
We often see people searching victims' names and suspects' names, addresses where they know a crime has occurred. When people come into Homicide Watch by searching those terms, I see that search term that they initially used to find me. A lot of times those give me clues on what's actually happening out there in the streets.
People will search for you as a crime reporter to find out about something you haven't written about, and you turn around and use their search parameters to search it yourself.
Exactly.
What sort of terms do you use when you're searching Twitter and Facebook?
It's taken a lot of practice to learn the terms that are most important in my community. I search RIP with and without periods, rest in paradise, SMH, short for shaking my head, tears, visual, V-I-S-U-A-L, is often used to mean vigil, for a candlelight vigil.
Can you give me an example of how it works?
Sure. A couple weekends ago, I woke up early one Sunday morning and checked the community listservs, as I often do, and saw that there was a police report that a juvenile male had died after being stabbed about 7:30 the evening before. And that happened on a street they listed as Quincy Street Northwest. When I looked at my Google analytics, I saw search terms, including killing of Jamal in D.C., October 8, 2011, a 16 was killed in Washington, D.C., and a man was murdered on Quincy Street Northwest on October 8, 2011. Those are all search terms that people were using to find my site.
So you had those clues, then what did you do?
I took those clues to Twitter, and I started searching Jamal, RIP, 16-year-old, and that led me to a Facebook profile of a 17-year-old named Jamar Freeman. His friends and family were leaving memorial messages connected to his Facebook and Twitter accounts. Finally, one of them linked to my initial report, just stating that a crime had occurred. At that point, that was confirmation for me.
So you don't go to the police after to make sure you've got it right?
A press release was eventually issued in that case. The press releases happen on their own time, and in this case, that wasn't until a day and a half later.
Do you ever worry about wrongly identifying someone?
I don't publish until I am absolutely certain that what I have is correct.
How is what you do different from what eventually comes out in the paper?
Homicide Watch is set up around people. We have individual pages for every victim and every suspect. Every story that I write appears on that victim or suspect's page. So with one click, you can see everything from their obituary to the initial report of the crime, to who was arrested, to where that is in the court's process, to maybe a profile, interesting comments that others have left in their memory, which is something that I think you don't see in a lot of either daily newspapers or news websites. Having that all in one place gives more of a complete picture than a crime brief every so often.
Do you try and cover every single homicide in D.C.?
Every single homicide.
Are you familiar with the great Miami crime reporter Edna Buchanan?
I am, yes.
She used to pride herself on knowing every homicide case in Miami. When she went on vacation, she would come back and check on the murders that she missed. And here's a story that she once told me.
And one was the murder of this young man who lived with his grandmother. And I happened to find myself in that neighborhood, and I stopped by, knocked at the door, And she opened it, and I introduced myself and said I wanted to talk to her about her grandson. And she took a deep breath, stepped back, threw the door open wide, and invited me in. And she said, I wondered why nobody came.
That's really what I find happens every day covering this beat. People have these deeply emotional moments. And what we see is that when they're not asked for their stories, and when they're not asked what happened, they get the impression that it doesn't matter. Their son's life or their mother's life wasn't worth talking about. And I think that's the saddest thing.
You remind me of Edna Buchanan.
Brooke, that story means so much to me, and that really just made my day.
Laura Amico runs Homicide Watch DC. Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Jody Avergan, with more help from Gianna Palmer and Doug Anderson, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Dylan Keefe and Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.